There's one case to be heard this morning. It is Carl R. Wagon Connect versus the Tax Commissioner of Ohio. Mr. Wagon Connect, please present your argument.
Mr. Commissioner, may it please the court. My name is Carl Wagon Connect, and before I proceed, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes rebuttal time.
Just watch your time, sir.
Thank you. There's a couple points I'd like to focus on. First, federal income tax liability and Ohio state tax liability are mutually exclusive and must independently be established, one from the other. Second, information received from the Internal Revenue Service by the Ohio Tax Commissioner pursuant to a contractual relationship was mere computations and calculations, which does not establish a federal tax liability, nor does it establish then an additional Ohio tax liability.
There's a question I want to ask at this point to make sure that I asked you, because before the court, of course, as you're well aware, is the order basically dismissing your case, both from the Board of Tax Appeals and the Commissioner.
Correct.
And I wanted to ask, I'm looking at this statute, 5747.10.
Correct.
Which I believe the Commissioner is relying on here. And it talks about filing an amended return. Now, did you file an amended return in this case?
Yes, as I understood. In 1996, a return was filed that was jointly without prejudice under UCC 2-07. Subsequent to that, and I reserved because I wasn't sure of procedurally what I was to do. Subsequent in 2000, I submitted an affidavit with the Ohio Tax Commissioner indicating that there was issues with the with the Internal Revenue Service. They were being resolved. They were then it became in litigation, and I would file any appropriate form subsequent to that. In 2004, I did file with the federal government, the Internal Revenue Service, and the Tax Commissioner of Revenue return affidavit statement. Now, all those actions to me comply that I filed everything that was required, because what I established during that period of time is that I and the general public is not required to file Form 1040. Case law substantiate that in my, there's arguments in it. I can go that and I can establish that at any point in time that I am not required to file a 1040. If I'm not required to file a 1040, there is no way that you can file an IT-1040 because everything is relied on information on the 1040.
Before we get into that legal argument, though, I'm simply trying to clarify the record here.
Okay.
Yes. You're saying you filed an Ohio return for 1996,
which was timely.
Originally back in 97.
Correct, when it was timely, as I understood it.
Did you file another Ohio return for taxable year 1996 later?
I'm stating that in 2000, I still wasn't clear what was to be done, and I filed an affidavit with the state of Ohio saying I'd filed any form. Each year, they've received more income or tax income. Let me rephrase that. Each year, the Ohio State Department of Taxation has received more than it is alleged owed. Because during this time, what I'm stating is I determined, and in 1996, what I filed was a return affidavit which established that I had no federal tax liability, which means that there was no adjusted gross income that you could put on a 1040. I was not required a 1040, so there was nothing to file.
Okay. And I just wanted to ask another question about this statute that the commissioner is pointing to. It talks about here the requirement for an amended return to be filed in Ohio, and there are several events on it. And let me just run through these as a factual matter to clarify the facts. This amended return shall be filed not later than 60 days after this federal tax adjustment has been agreed to. Now, I take it that you've not agreed with the federal government on the adjustment, the tax?
Correct. In fact, 1996 is still in litigation in two different courts, and that's one of the things I've continually said. The issues are not resolved with that. There's one in district court that is still active. There's one in tax court that is still active.
Okay. And the statute then goes on, agreed to or finally determined, and you're saying there's still federal litigation pending?
There is still active.
With respect to year 1996?
With respect to year 1996.
Okay. And then it goes on to say, or any federal income tax deficiency has been assessed or paid. Has the federal government issued an assessment to you with respect to the 1996 year?
And that's what's in litigation.
So they
have. Because the information that was received, and it's in the brief, is erroneous. It's demonstrated, and it's before the court still right now. And the one part, which is the major part, is the income tax liability, has been going back, in fact, resigned to another judge and so on, has been nearly 2 years. On the 1996.
So the federal government did issue this assessment, and your argument is that it was improper for them to issue it, or?
I'm stating right in the record here, I included the my account transcript, which is the individual master file, which is required. And in there, it demonstrates in their own record that one, the statute of limitations had passed before they issued any assessment. Two, there's a reference to a transaction code 494, but the federal government requires to be included. It is not. Both of those two things, such numerous other things, which is in that record, demonstrates that one, everything they did was beyond the statute of limitations, and secondly, they did not comply with their own rules and regulations regarding issuing a notice of deficiency.
So you're saying that the assessment issued by the federal government was procedurally deficient?
In all aspects, it was null and void. They used erroneous information. For example, one of the points is that I cannot get to the underlying facts. You're arguing a federal tax liability. I'm saying I can demonstrate that even of itself, information that's on the record, which is like in the one record is a tax, capital gains tax. I could not argue that that is totally bogus, and I can explain totally why it is bogus. But that's what is all the calculations through it. And if you want me to, I can explain why that is bogus.
Well, no, but because the substantive issues, of course, nobody could get to here because of
this.
And
that's exactly correct, because I'm left in a catch-22. You're petitioning for reassessment of the calculations of the Ohio Tax Commissioner. That's the key point, is that they're taking information that they receive under a contractual relationship, which is not valid, erroneous, there is no checks and balances on it, and there is no way for me to bring information to them to say that it is bogus and not credible, not accurate, or whatever. For example, it's like if you got a credit card. A merchant says you made a purchase. The credit card company says, here's your statement. And they say, you owe this, and here's your finances, starts going on. And I go, time out. I never even have an account with you, credit card company, nor have I ever been in that store, and so on. Yet they keep going on, and there is no way to argue the point. That's what's happening. That's why I say there has to be a point where that information has to be checked. And if I, as an Ohio citizen, go and say to the Ohio Tax Commissioner, this information is totally bogus. There has to be a means of checks and balance. What it is right now is information. Whatever they get, if it's off the bathroom wall, anywhere, they'll use that information to make their calculations. The petition for reassessment is to look to their calculations. And I have no doubt that the calculations are correct based upon the information, but the information should never have been given to them, but since it was given to it, I should have the right to dispute that information, which I'm not.
Well, and I guess what the board held and the commissioner would be saying is that you can contest it on the merits, but you had to comply with a couple of these requirements in the statute. And if if the federal government issued the assessment, then there was that requirement that you file the amended return. And if you don't do that, then they're saying, well, if you didn't file the amended return, then you have to pay the Ohio assessment, but then you can go ahead and contest it.
Again, U.S. Supreme Court has held that that's only, not the U.S., the Ohio Supreme Court, that the federal tax liability is merely a measuring tool. It does not invoke liability. They're mutually exclusive. So you can look over and say, here's a standard, and this is what you're looking at. But what it does not invoke, and at the federal level, the revenue agents by United States versus Taylor does not invoke any federal tax liability. They're mere calculations. So the federal government hasn't even completed their burden because it's still in litigation up there. That information is a measuring tool, but it does not mean I have Ohio tax liability. Two distinct things. Secondly, I reinforce that according to everything, and that's my other point, is there is no form for you to file by the Ohio tax commissioner if you are arguing that you're not required to file a 1040. The Payne case in federal court gives you the parameters to establish that you how to have a document meet the criteria of a return. It's a four-prong test. The point being is, if there is a case law multiple in federal court, tax court, or whatever, that there's a way to have a form, then there is not a requirement that everybody has to file a 1040. If everybody was required to file a 1040, there would not be that need for the case law. Ohio has put all their eggs in a basket with a form 1040. And if you cannot file a 1040, and that's what I'm saying, the jurid in and of itself, I would violate Ohio Revised Code 5703.25 and 3.26 by signing that jurid knowingly that I cannot do a 1040.
So you would...
I'm arguing that...
You would concede, though, that under this statute, 5747.10, it does say that you should file an amended return, but you're objecting to that because it means you have to swear under penalties of perjury that something's correct that you're disputing. Is that your case?
2 points. That point...
Okay.
And the other point that I already met all the requirements that there is no amended return based upon that there was what I filed with the government in federal government in 1996, and what I've continually filed and kept the Ohio State Commissioner abreast of what was going on, there is nothing at this point in time to file, because in that original affidavit in 2000, I said, you know, if there's anything to form. It's not that the Ohio State has not received everything that they are entitled to do, that they allege, and more. They have since this time, because I'm still in litigation. And that was the third point I've continually said, wait till all the litigation is done, everything clears. Because the issues have not went forward. I see that.
That's a 5-minute warning.
No, it's two.
2-minute warning, sorry.
Okay.
You may reserve your time or continue.
I'll reserve the time.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Wagenknecht. Mr. Clifford.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Damian Clifford. I'm here on behalf of the Tax Commissioner. May it please the Court, I want to go through some of these issues that have been brought up.
I'd like to ask you a question first.
Sure.
Under the statute that I was reading with Mr. Wagenknecht, I take it the Tax Commissioner's position is that Mr. Wagenknecht should have filed an amended return?
Correct.
And what event is it under that statute that occurred that triggered that requirement?
Well, I think there's two that you pointed out. One, it's been finally determined, and secondly, they've been assessed. If we go and look at, and you've already raised this issue of the merits could be addressed if he prepaid the petition for reassessment under 5747.13(e)(2). The fact that he didn't...
Well, of course, that's a pretty hefty payment to have to make. So to get to this question of whether or not he had to file this return, does the record in this case show what action the feds took or whatever that triggered the requirement of filing the amended return?
We have the actual adjustment by the IRS in the record. It's located at statutory transcript, page 11, second supplement, page 3. It's the adjustment by the federal government of his 1996 return.
Okay, now, but does that, it says 60 days after the adjustment has been agreed to or finally determined, so the issuance of that adjustment wouldn't have triggered the amended return in Ohio, right?
He was assessed January 10, 2003 by the IRS. So from that...
Is that document in the record?
I don't believe it's in the record. However, there is subsequent case law after the brief was filed by the tax court and by the district court, which specifically goes through each individual facts of the federal cases that were filed. Plus, I believe the cases in the Northern District and the Sixth Circuit do also go through the facts to say when he was assessed and goes through the factual background of his.
Well, some of those cases were issued very recently, right?
The other cases, they started back in 01, honestly, but the most recent ones that were filed with our brief were in 06,
a couple of months
07.
Ago.
The other cases that just came out were in July of 08. In the most recent tax court case, the court states that Mr. Wagenknecht missed his time to contest the validity of the IRS assessment. So they held in the tax court that it's beyond dispute that he can now contest it under a federal statute. Since I didn't file that with the brief, I don't want to go into the specific statute, but I can supplement the record after the argument indicating when it was done. And as to his other arguments, the court held that they were immaterial, groundless, irrelevant, meritless, and unworthy of being addressed as to him contesting the validity of the 1040 and him having 1996 income tax returns.
But going back to when the tax commissioner acted in
right.
this matter,
sure,
it's not, you're not contending that, or are you, that the federal liability was already finally determined? Was it already finally
yes,
determined?
Yes, it was. Because what happened in this instance is that Mr. Wagenknecht, after the fact, after it was done, after he's missed his time to contest it, went and filed an action. It's simply like saying that if you have if something's barred by the statute of limitations and you go file an action, that it's still pending. Well, it's not, because it's barred by the statute of limitations. The same thing happened in the federal issue here. So him contesting and file these actions way after the fact doesn't make the ability to contest those valid.
Okay.
So,
and then are you also contending that there was an assessment referred to here, the assessment of the deficiency by the federal? You mentioned the date on that.
January 10, 2003. It's in the federal court cases discussing the facts of the background of these specific cases, because he filed two cases in Northern District of Ohio and then also one in tax court, and the Northern District of Ohio action was dismissed as the merits of the tax liability, but was allowed to continue as to the civil penalty imposed by the IRS for him filing a frivolous return in 96. So the assessment was finally resolved by the IRS, and then after that time is when the Ohio Department of Taxation in 2005 issued its assessment and told Mr. Wang that he had to prepay this amount with his petition for reassessment in order to vest the tax commissioner in jurisdiction. The fact that he doesn't prepay ends his ability to contest the merits of the issue. Secondly, I think that the federal court system and the tax system would have the ability to address the merits of his tax issues, which they already have. So, I mean, I think that the claims brought forth now are just simply barred because he didn't.
Well, I thought you said that they had not been able to address them for procedural reasons at the federal level either?
No.
Okay.
In the federal level, they did address them. What I'm saying is, as to the actual tax liability, they said he missed his time to contest that.
Okay.
So it's finally resolved, and even in the federal court system, he's unable to contest it for the fact that he didn't petition or file his petition for reassessment. I don't know how the federal tax system works specifically, but he missed his time frame to which contest that actual tax liability from 96, and therefore it's finally resolved and it won't be addressed because of the fact that he missed it. The only thing that's pending now is the imposition of the civil penalties regarding the same tax year for having a frivolous return.
Let me ask you, in reviewing the final determination and the BTA decision in this case, both rely I'm right, am I not, on this 5747.10 and, of course, 5747.13 as well?
Correct.
And yet neither of them has a finding of fact with respect to, you know, the date an assessment was issued or any of these other events that would have triggered his need to file an amended Ohio return. And my question to you is, you know, why isn't there some finding in there that makes it fully clear?
Why isn't the date in there?
Right.
I can't answer that question as to why the specific date's in there. However, I know that the department doesn't act until after it's been finally determined. But they wait a period of time to ensure that that issue's been resolved and beyond the statute of limitations for the federal government before it issues its assessment to ensure that there's no issues as to subsequent appeals or contesting of the underlying federal tax liability. And upon that time, and I believe that the statutory transcript, though, in that actual assessed amended return by the federal government, as I noted before, statutory transcript page 11 and second supplement page 3, does have a date on there that would indicate when that was assessed and therefore would satisfy the statute. So even though it may not be referred to in the final determination, I believe it's in the statutory transcript, which would indicate the actual date on there.
So there's a federal document in the statutory transcript that states the date that the assessment was issued?
Yeah, on page 11 of the statutory transcript.
Okay. Well, we can review that.
Well, it doesn't have a date. It just has the return form and the tax at issue. There's only page 1 of 2. It doesn't have the second page. So we would ask, I believe there's other issues that have been brought up.
Well, yeah, there's the issue of signing the jurat on the return. Now, let's assume that he was required to file an amended return. He's saying, I dispute this liability. This is not, you know, this is not what I believe to be true in good faith, and yet you're saying Ohio law requires him to sign it. Why is that not a problem?
Well, it's not you don't even get to the fact because he didn't prepay the petition for reassessment. So you don't get by the statute.
Well, but he would have the precondition for not having to prepay on the assessment would have been filing the amended return on time, right? Or filing it before the assessment was issued.
Filing it within 60 days of the IRS making the assessment or being finally determined, he would have had to file an amended return, which he didn't do.
Which he didn't do, but you're saying he was required to do that, and he, in doing that, he would have had to sign under penalties of perjury. This is, to the best of my knowledge and belief, what my liability is. And he's saying that, you know, that wasn't my position as to what my liability is. Why isn't that a problem?
Because he didn't even do that. He didn't even file. He didn't even file his affidavit saying it's zero tax liability in '96 after the IRS did its facts, figures, and computations altered and affected his tax liability. He didn't file an amended return saying, yeah, they've done this, but I still disagree with it, and it should be zero.
So you're saying he could have filed the return. Would it have been okay if he filed the amended return and did not sign it? Would that have complied?
Well, I mean, I think what he's done before is he signed documents and he did his under the UCC, which I don't agree with, but he's filed it, written on it, and said that it's with reserve of rights, that he's not contesting the validity of it, but he understands he has to file it, so he does. Okay. So theoretically, he could have filed it with a zero return after the 60 days. However, he didn't, which gets us to 5747.13(e)(2), which says that he had to file an amended return. He didn't, therefore he had to prepay that amount. And the 10th District and the U.S. Supreme Court have looked at these prepayment provisions, and this court has done it on numerous occasions, saying you must prepay petitions for reassessment to vest the court with jurisdiction. So this court, the U.S. Supreme Court, the Court of Appeals has addressed a specific statute saying the prepayment provisions comply with McKesson and are constitutional. So for him to come in here now after he doesn't have jurisdiction and didn't prepay and say that it's not valid, I think he's barred from doing that.
Okay, he contends that he filed an affidavit with the Department of Taxation in 2000.
Right, but would have still been before the IRS finally determined his 1996 income tax liability.
Okay, so that that doesn't operate to legally substitute in any way for that return?
No, it would not. Because there wasn't a final there wasn't an assessment or a finally determined by the IRS that altered his facts, figures, and computations under 574710. So even if he would have filed it, even if you want to claim that's an amended return, it's still not an amended return because there was no alteration of his federal adjusted gross tax liability by the IRS until after that. And, and since he didn't file an amended return within 60 days of that alteration, I think it's immaterial.
Okay.
So.
And Mr. WagonConnect has asked for a hearing at the Board of Tax Appeals, and he has talked about that in his notice of appeal to this court. But the BTA didn't give him a hearing on any issue, even the jurisdictional issues. Is that appropriate for the BTA to have done?
I believe so. I mean, why allow a party to discuss merit issues when you don't even vest the BTA and the tax commission with jurisdiction to even get your foot in the door?
But what about the jurisdictional issues themselves? If he wants to contend, you know, there are reasons why.
I don't think he disputes that he doesn't satisfy the statute. I mean, he doesn't satisfy 5747.13(e)(2). I think he simply just says that he disagrees with it, doesn't think he has to comply. Because he has a basic disagreement.
But he says in his brief that he's not under E2, but under E8, which is that catch-all. I mean, he's saying that E2 doesn't apply to him.
But that's just a complete misapplication of the law, considering he has to file an amended return at 574710, and E2 specifically references that if you have to file an amended return under 574710, you must prepay. So, I mean, I don't understand what evidence he could present which would demonstrate that he doesn't qualify, doesn't have to file an amended return when it's clear that he does.
Well, and I guess if he argues that it's not clear that he does and argues that he wants to present evidence of some kind on that, would the board have to give him a hearing on that?
No, because there's no jurisdiction with the BTA, because there's no jurisdiction with the tax commissioner.
But if he's even contesting the very issue of whether or not there was jurisdiction, can he present evidence on that?
I would think not, no. I don't believe that he would have any ability to contest it for the fact that it's a pure legal determination, unnecessary of the facts that he can bring forward, which will demonstrate that the statutes don't apply. I mean, the General Assembly had an ability to determine in doing the statutes which regarding the BTA and their jurisdiction, and they said, you know, that actually, you know, have to vest the BTA of jurisdiction, and they don't have to give a hearing if there's no jurisdiction. And that's what allows these affirmance orders from the BTA to be issued when the tax commissioner doesn't have jurisdiction, and the BTA has held that its jurisdiction, and this court has held that the BTA's jurisdiction is derivative from the jurisdiction imposed upon the tax commissioner. And since there's no jurisdiction with the tax commissioner, there's no jurisdiction with the BTA. And again, if we get back to what we were talking about before, these are issues that Mr. Wagonneck could have vested jurisdiction with the tax commissioner, but didn't because he didn't comply with the statute. And regardless of any of that, the federal court system has addressed his merit issues and said they're meritless.
I'm going to go back over that, though, one more time. If the tax commissioner issues a final determination saying, we're not going to hear your petition for reassessment because you didn't prepay and because you needed to prepay because of these statutes that you didn't comply with, and then he files an appeal with the Board of Tax Appeals and says, well, that was erroneous and unlawful, the tax commissioner should have heard my petition for reassessment, and Board of Tax Appeals, I want a hearing to show that these legal requirements weren't triggered or whatever, you're saying the BTA still doesn't have to give him a hearing even on those jurisdictional issues?
Because I don't believe that if you don't have jurisdiction with the tax commissioner, I mean, these are clear legal issues that are presented that are a lack of jurisdiction. You don't file it within 60 days. So the question becomes is, say, with the 60-day requirement, so if someone files it on the 80th day, they should be able to go to the BTA and say, well, I know I didn't file it timely, but I should be allowed to anyway because my dog was sick. I mean, I just don't think that it presents relevant evidence. The strict construction of these statutes from this court saying that you have to comply to vest with the BTA and the tax commissioner jurisdiction.
You would agree it would be easier to make the argument you're making if the tax commissioner's final determination had set forth in detail findings as to why it was he needed to file the amended return, that he didn't file the amended return, that therefore he had to prepay, that because he didn't prepay, and yet there's like a, you know, one sentence determination saying, you know, you didn't pay, therefore you don't get heard.
I understand what you're saying. I mean, you're saying that the final determination could be a little bit beefier, so to speak. But I think that the record itself does speak to all the issues, maybe not as clearly as the court would like, but I believe that everything is contained in that record, which would answer all those questions, which indicates why the BTA and the tax commissioner lack jurisdiction.
Okay, your time's expired. Thank you, Mr. Clifford.
Thank you.
Mr. Wagenknecht, you've reserved 1 minute and 42 seconds for rebuttal.
Okay, thank you. I just want to make a couple points. First off, he made the statement that there's no way that I can demonstrate not required to file a 1040. I do have a document. It's not part of the record. It's subsequent that would establish in a court that I'm not required to file a 1040. Secondly, he totally misrepresents everything that happened in the federal court, in U.S. District Court, and the tax court regarding my case regarding 1996. First off, in district court, it was split. There was a $1,500 civil penalty that went to district court, which I was requiring the other issues into tax court. In tax court over right now, it is still active. There is not resolution. There is motions pending. In fact, right now, the other side was supposed to have filed their response yesterday. That is still active. It is not final. It is not determined. And there is still merits to the issues on there. In the district court, which he totally misrepresents, is that it was dismissed sub ponte. I filed a motion in appeals, went to appeals. The other side, because the opinion actually supported my positions, the government filed for a motion of en banc hearing. En banc hearing took place, and the court remanded back, and it has now been mandated back to the district court to say comply because his arguments do have merit. And whether there is as trivial as you say, he still has the right for those to be heard. So my cases do have merit in both. He has totally represented what has happened in there. And as far as the jurat, it's not only the jurat itself. The jurat down at the bottom says that you must sign under penalty. It's a perjury. I'm sorry, my time is up.
Just finish that sentence.
It says you must sign under penalty of perjury. 28 U.S.C. 1746 states specifically two different types of jurat. One, which I am required by that to sign under penalties of perjury under the laws of the United States of America. The jurat that they would have you sign is under penalties of perjury, which is different, and I am not permitted by law to file. And that would put me in conflict of federal law and state law.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Wagner. This case will be submitted, and the court will advise the parties of its decision.